Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Well, Michael, did you see what we were able to accomplish?
I did not.
You had a well-known fugitive that was like a prolific mobster back in like the 30s and 40s. He lived to the age of 91, surviving gangster attacks, and he was involved in 11 murders and evaded the FBI and was finally sentenced for his involvement in these murders and everything else. Lived a long and gangsterous life. They move him to a West Virginia prison for 2 days, and he's dead.
Yeah, West Virginia's tough.
Yeah.
It's a hard knock life here.
Man, probably some damn hillbilly ate him or something. I don't know what happened. All I know is they put him in there, and next thing you know, he's dead. How does that happen?
Well, I read that one of the chief suspects in it is another mob hitman who did not like people who were quote-unquote rats or people who were, I guess, beat women or something like that, which Whitey Bulger, who you were talking about, was alleged to have been both a rat and to beat women. So
yeah, but and there's several movies that were made about some of his exploits as a gangster and stuff like that. But what I don't understand, though, is was this guy already in prison or did he break into prison to kill him?
I don't know.
That's what I mean. There's more questions than there are answers. All we know is that they moved him to West Virginia. He was here 2 days and he's dead and it was murder. But they didn't even know. A lot of people are saying, why did they move him? When did they move him? It's like the government didn't even know that he was being moved.
Yeah.
So, like, what level did this plot arise to?
I don't know, but his lawyer was very critical of it in an article I read, too.
Yeah.
Basically saying that the U.S. government sentenced him to death by moving him to West Virginia.
Well, there's a lot of people that have felt that way. On the railroad, that's the way it was.
Yeah.
You'd have these people that got transferred into Huntington because they used to have the main centers on the CSX, and Huntington was one of the main divisions on CSX.
It's one of the main veins.
Yeah, I mean, right there along with Baltimore and Richmond and Cincinnati and Detroit and Chicago and Huntington. You got them right there. So when the people would get transferred for some of these bigger cities, they get transferred to Huntington. They thought they got dropped off the end of the earth.
Well, do you know what the largest inland port in the United States is?
Huntington.
Yeah.
I know.
It's not the world, but I think it's definitely the United States.
Yeah. I used to work at the yard there in Huntington, and that's where we shuffled all the coal in and around through there. And I had to work to develop new ways to move the coal cars through so we could get that volume into the coal tipples and back out.
Sounds like we're getting dangerously close to Tommy's railroad stories here.
Well, I do have a couple of awards on my desk for my great management. But, you know, they say pride goeth before fall. It was just a few years later when they were showing me the door there with a check to go with me. There you go. We don't need you anymore. Thanks.
Here's the caboose.
Yeah, I am the caboose.
Well, this episode, we wanted to pick something a little bit kind of topical, something that's going on in the news. And there's nothing more topical than this right now, I don't think. Well, I mean, the elections maybe, but...
Well, the elections, but by the time this comes out, it's going to be Monday before the election on Tuesday, so we can't have much impact on that.
Speaking of which, I don't know, did you check the mail today?
I think Mary got it before I got home.
There were probably about 12 to 15 different flyers, like large paper-sized flyers in there with all kinds of... advertisements for different political campaigns.
Yeah, we've been getting that every day the last 2 weeks.
And the weird thing about these ones, I mean, now there were two. There was one for a magistrate race, which was just kind of information about the magistrate, which was, you know, fine. There's another one by Chad Lovejoy, who's a friend of ours. He's running for House.
Mm-hmm.
He's an incumbent. And it was just about Chad and himself. Then the rest of them were just attack ads against the other candidates.
Right.
And I am so sick and tired of seeing it. And it was like, I think I want to do like a cloud map of the words. And they were going to be like, you know, Wall, Trump, Pelosi, Cole,
Opioids.
Ape opioids, patriot, flag, America.
Well, I mean, we've got one of the races that's nationally, you know, nationally of national interest because it's about one that they're trying to flip the seat and everything.
Yeah.
And so all these people from outside the state are pumping all kinds of money in about it. But the thing is, both of them are accusing the other one of being responsible for the opioid epidemic.
Yeah.
And so they both did that. Both of them are accusing the other one of not really caring about the people of West Virginia, that they're only there to enrich themselves. So at the end of the day, you got two lousy SOBs, and you, which lousy SOB are you going to vote for?
I know.
I mean, that's the way they would lead you to believe in the advertising.
Yeah. I actually already voted. Got my early voting done.
Well, all I can say is, if you don't vote, don't complain. So get out and vote. So, you know, do your part. Even though I read in my Freakonomics book that going to vote is the least economical thing you can do in your life.
Really?
Yep. They went through all the statistics, and I can't remember them all, but they went through all the statistics, and they said it has the least value of anything you do in your life.
Hmm.
But, you know, that's a numbers guy for you.
That's contrary to everything I believe in.
Everything as an American. As an American, you got to go vote. America, love it or leave it, by God.
Well, to become an American, you have to be a citizen.
That's true. You do have to be a citizen.
And this episode is going to be about birthright citizenship and about how people who are born here in the United States, even though they might not be born to American citizens, if they're born here on U.S. soil, how they are U.S. citizens just by being born here.
Yeah, and the main reason that it's suddenly of a topical nature is that Trump has said that he's going to issue an executive order changing that.
That's right. Now, he says a lot of things.
True. He does say a lot of things.
He tweets a lot of things.
Some things he says and some things he tweets.
During his executive time.
Or that's when he's in the bathroom on the toilet and that's when he tweets?
I don't know. Well, it's for like 8 hours a day, so he must
That's what Kimmel told me, so I don't think Kimmel would lie.
But birthright citizenship has two different ways it can kind of be conferred. The first is, these are different Latin terms, jus soli, that's J-U-S. I guess that's how you pronounce that. I don't know. I haven't spoken Latin in quite some time.
Jus soli.
Maybe it's jus, because I think the J is like kind of silent.
No, that's the way they say it in New Jersey.
Jus guys?
Jus guys.
So jus soli or jus sanguinis. And so basically, with those two theories and pursuant to the 14th Amendment to the Constitution and the Immigration and Nationality Act, U.S. citizenship is automatically granted to any person born within and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Now, like I said, those are Latin terms, and lawyers love Latin terms, so I took Latin class in high school and part of college, so I'm going to explain to you what those Latin terms mean.
Gallia est in Europa.
See.
No, it's not C.
We.
It's not even we.
Yeah. Gallia is...
Just nod, you'll get away with it.
Gallia is France, isn't it?
That's right.
That's why I said we.
Oh, well, okay, you can answer that, but it's not Latin.
Oh, I feel like there was a sudden rush of air in here.
Came through my ears.
Jus soli is Latin, and it means right of the soil. And jus soli was part of actually English common law. Now, this is different than the jus sanguinis, which is from Roman law. And where it exists, pretty much, this whole jus soli thing, it's not actually unconditional except in a couple of places. And that's pretty much here in America and Canada as well. Now, there's other countries, too, but they're not really kind of mainstream countries. It doesn't actually exist in Europe unless it's kind of qualified. There's different kind of qualifications. So not just being born there in a certain country doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a citizen, unlike it does here in Canada and also the United States. Now, the other thing you can compare it with is jus sanguinis, which sanguinis, you know, obviously means like sanguine, like blood.
Like sangria.
Sangria. Mm-hmm. And basically that means it's citizenship is not determined by the place of birth, but by having one or both of the parents who are citizen of that state. So by blood.
Correct.
So if you have an American or U.S. citizen as a parent, then by de facto, you are a U.S. citizen as well.
Regardless of where you're at when you're born.
Exactly. So
That would take care of, like, people being stationed overseas in the military or something like that. You wouldn't want to be stationed overseas serving your country and you have a baby that's born and they're not a citizen.
No, I mean, that would be actually...
Un-American.
Un-American. It would be really bad. I wouldn't like that at all.
Yeah, they wouldn't either, I would assume. I mean, unless you don't like kids.
So now with those two being the kind of different theories, you also have the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment to our Constitution is pretty important in this whole birthright citizenship thing as well.
Yeah, that's why I kind of like going over this today, because we've gone over the 14th Amendment before. And then there's another, well, it's not an amendment, but it's an act that we went over before that's tied into this too.
But before you get to the 14th Amendment, you kind of have to ask yourself, where did that case come from, or where did that amendment come from? And it comes from the Dred Scott case. Mm-hmm. And if you're not familiar with the Dred Scott case, it's a U.S. Supreme Court decision. And just a couple different taglines about it. It's been hailed by scholars as universally condemned as the U.S. Supreme Court's worst decision. And one historian said is unquestionably our court's worst decision ever. So basically it's not something that we're particularly proud of. It's just it's a bad case in our history.
Well, it was also a way to try to rectify some of the problems brought about through slavery.
It was, yeah.
And I mean, and when they put the 14th Amendment in place, is because the slaves that were brought here were not citizens.
That's true, yeah.
And they had to make a path for them to become citizens. And even though it was hard to define the ones that were already here, by making this, if you're born here, then that would at least ensure that all their children would be able to be U.S. citizens.
Yeah. So the Dred Scott decision, and here's kind of a little synopsis of what it said. It held that a Negro, and this is like their terminology, so a Negro whose ancestors were imported into the U.S. and sold as slaves, whether enslaved or free, could not be an American citizen and therefore had no standing to sue in federal court, and that the federal government had no power to regulate slavery in the federal territories acquired after the creation of the United States. Dred Scott, an enslaved man of the Negro African race who had been taken by his owners to free states and territories, attempted to sue for his freedom. In a 7-2 decision written by Chief Justice Roger B. Taney, the court denied Scott's request. The decision was only the second time the Supreme Court overruled an act of Congress to be unconstitutional. And also, kind of like I said, became a bit of a catalyst for the Civil War as well, because it kind of threw the whole slavery issue into kind of a bit of a spin.
Yeah, that was in 1857.
Yeah. So that case, you read about that in law school, that's kind of like one of those, this is not a good case.
No. That's one of the Supreme Court's less shining moments, huh?
Oh, absolutely. There's a couple of them out there, but that one stands out as being a really bad one. So that kind of led to the 14th Amendment being passed. And basically the part of the 14th Amendment we're going to talk about, which pertains to birthright citizenship, is in Section 1, which is called the Citizenship Clause. And it says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So, I mean, that seems pretty clear cut if you look at it, the way it reads. Wouldn't you think?
Well, yes and no.
There are two sides to it. I mean, agree.
Well, it depends on how you interpret exactly the wording of that phrase. And then also, as you said before, sometimes when the law maybe is vague or ambiguous, you refer to the discussions behind the law, and they have the notes on what took place on the discussion and debate about it.
Yeah, that's right. Whenever something's ambiguous, you can look to like the legislative history to determine. Usually it's like what was said in committee or things like that, because that's where these kinds of laws are usually fleshed out a bit more than not really on the floor.
Right.
You can look to the notes and kind of figure out what are they thinking.
And there's notes from when this debate took place, when the amendment was offered, about what exactly defines citizenship. So then there were some exclusions that were put in there that they said, this is what we're not intending to do. So we can get to that there in a little bit.
Yeah. So basically the provisions of this section have been interpreted by the courts to the effect that basically any child that is born on United States soil are U.S. citizenships. And like I said, this is kind of a blanket jus soli type argument that doesn't really exist anywhere except here So it's not something that happens in Europe. It's basically just here in the United States. There's been two Supreme Court cases, which are very kind of, I guess they're pertinent to the discussion of this. But I think before we get to those two Supreme Court cases, there might be some motions before the court today.
Well, we have a motion that we would like to approach the bench, the juice sleigh, if you will.
Juice guys, come on up.
Well, thank you. We have today with us Sleep Number. It's good to have them back because we need a good sleep.
That's right. We all know that sleep is important, but consider someone you know who is in the military or a veteran. Imagine how much a good night's sleep means to them.
Well, we know a few of those.
We do.
From military heroes to everyday heroes, just like a lawyer, the new Sleep Number 360 smart beds help everyone get the proven quality sleep that will change their life.
A lawyer can either be a hero or a villain, or sometimes both at the same time. It just depends.
On which side you're on.
That's right.
Hero to a zero.
So just like people disagree about lawyers, many couples disagree about mattress firmness.
And their lawyer firmness.
And their lawyer firmness. Sleep Number beds let you choose your ideal firmness on each side, so it's just right for the both of you.
The new beds are so smart, they sense your every move and automatically adjust to you, keeping you sleeping comfortably throughout the night. Boy, I wish I was that smart.
If you come in during the Veterans Day sale, you'll save $400 on a Sleep Number 360 C4 smart bed. Now only $12.99. And that's a queen-size bed. Plus, there's an exclusive savings reserved for military and veterans.
But you don't have to be a military or veteran to come in and enjoy these savings. There are still good savings and value to be earned. And Sleep Number is also the official sleep and wellness partner of the NFL. So the way those guys get knocked around, if they can sleep on a bed afterwards, man, they must be good beds.
That's right.
You'll only find Sleep Number at one of their 550 Sleep Number stores nationwide.
Visit sleepnumber.com/court to find the one nearest you. Go look it up. Go find a Sleep Number store. Go try one out. You're going to like it.
At sleepnumber.com/court. And if you want to learn more about home wellness and tech from the leader in smarter sleep, visit the Sleep Number blog at blog.sleepnumber.com.
That's right.
And Mike and Tommy say, nighty-night.
Now, the two Supreme Court decisions, there's the Elk v. Wilkins case and the U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark case. Wong Kim Ark is one of my favorites. I just like the name of it. Elk v. Wilkins. Now, this is basically established that Indian tribes represented independent political powers with no allegiance to the U.S., and that their peoples were under a special jurisdiction of the U.S. So basically, children born to Indian tribes, therefore, did not automatically receive citizenship under the 14th Amendment if they voluntarily left their tribe. So basically, what they were saying by this decision is that if you had an American Indian, Native American, and they were born on a reservation, and they were part of that tribe, and then they left that tribe, they actually weren't U.S. citizens because that technically wasn't, that was kind of like sovereign soil. It's kind of a very strange thought if you think about it.
Well, I thought it was the opposite of that. I thought that if they could retain their rights to their tribal membership, or they could become U.S. citizens, which then meant they were no longer part. In other words, they had their choice whether they wanted to be a U.S. citizen or not.
Well, the ones that Indian tribes that pay taxes are exempt from that ruling because they were actually already citizens by an earlier act of Congress. This was for all non-citizen Indians. But actually, as of 1924, that became kind of a moot point due to the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924. But the important thing to take away from this is pretty much the theory that if you were not under the jurisdiction of the United States, because that's the way that one part of the Citizenship Clause reads, is that basically all persons born or naturalized in the United States and not subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the states where they reside.
So if they were on the reservations, they were not subject to all jurisdiction thereof.
Right. That's the way I read that. So, yeah, they were not subject to the whole jurisdiction thereof, so therefore they would not be U.S. citizens.
Okay.
So, now the second case is the Wong Kim Ark case, and that's where the Supreme Court held that under the 14th Amendment, a man born within the U.S. to foreigners, in this case it was some Chinese citizens, who have a permanent domicile and residence in the U.S. and are carrying on business in the U.S. and who were not employed in a diplomatic or other official capacity by a foreign power, was a citizen of the U.S. So, more broadly, the court characterized the statement, all persons born in the U.S. and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States, as the broad and clear words of the Constitution, ruling that Wong's U.S. citizenship had been acquired by birth and had not been lost or taken away by anything happening since his birth. So those were the two kind of precedential type cases.
And here's one of the things to remember, though, in that is both of the Chinese mother and father were both here legally.
Yeah.
They were under visas or work visas or something to that effect.
Yep.
And when they were here.
That's true.
So they had entered the country in a legal manner.
Right. And that's been a point of discussion that's been brought up by different politicians regarding the status, whether somebody's here legally or illegally.
Well, and that's one of the things, though, is this ruling is the one that's cited in most cases as to why the birthright citizenship stands up.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take into account the fact that the citizens were here, the foreigners were here legally.
That's true.
So that's kind of like, people overinterpreted that law, if according to some people, the way they look at it, is that that was an overinterpretation of what the law meant.
What, that decision?
No, that later on, when people refer to that ruling and say, see, that's why anybody that comes in and has a baby here can stay. It goes back to that. They were here and they were foreigners. They were staying on there and they had it. So that's been ruled by the Supreme Court.
That's true. I think that's one of the interesting things about the law in general is that there are these kind of gray areas that leaves it open to interpretation and argument. So, and I think that's something that would probably be best taken up by a legislative body and probably not an executive order. We're kind of coming back to the whole full circle to the whole Trump decision.
Well, and the executive order, when you look at that, the constitutional basis for an executive order is the president's broad power to issue executive directives. According to the Congressional Research Service, there is no direct definition of executive orders, presidential memoranda, and proclamations in the U.S. Constitution. There is likewise no specific provision authorizing their issuance. However, as we saw with his executive order on immigration, on the immigration ban,
mm-hmm.
it is subject to courts finding whether it is legal or constitutional.
Yeah, and typically, the executive branch does deal with immigration pretty much. That's kind of their purview. It's one of the things that the Congress has kind of granted to the executive branch to enforce that.
Yeah, and it's not like they're uncommon, because every president since George Washington has used executive orders for different things, whether it's just to declare a national holiday. Thanksgiving was first issued as a executive order, as a national holiday. Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War using an executive order. Supreme Court Justice Roger Taney, in his role as a federal circuit judge, ruled that Lincoln's executive order was unconstitutional in a decision called Ex Pate Merriman. Lincoln and the Union Army ignored Taney, and the Congress didn't contest Lincoln's habeas corpus decisions.
Yeah. Taney is the chief judge on the Dred Scott decision. He's a pretty polarizing jurist.
And then two other executive orders comprise Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. So they have been used, by all of them. In 1957, President Eisenhower used an executive order to put the Arkansas National Guard under federal control and to enforce desegregation in Little Rock.
One thing that kind of gets me, and I know we're trying to make this kind of more informational, not so much of a political type thing, is that, when President Obama was the president, it seemed like the right was all these executive orders. Who's Obama think he is? He's a dictator. These executive orders.
Mm-hmm.
And now that Trump is president, they're they don't have a problem with the executive orders. They're like, oh, it's fine. He can do that. I think people really, and not that, probably not any of our listeners would think this way, because our listeners are educated, smart people. But you know, I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. You got to keep it pretty much even keel. If you think executive orders are bad, they're bad for both presidents. If you think they're good for both presidents. It doesn't depend on who the party is, which that was one of the things that's always very frustrating to me with mm-hmm. politics these days. It doesn't really matter.
Oh, yeah.
It's more about who
says it. It's how you spin it.
Yeah.
You know, if it's on your side, then it's a good thing. If it's on the other side, well, it's a bad thing, using it for bad. President Truman issued a robust 896 executive orders over his almost 8 years in office. Now, Obama issued 277. George W. Bush issued 291, and Bill Clinton had 364.
Yeah.
But you know who the most prolific executive order issuer has been?
Who?
One you wouldn't think of. Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter?
He averaged almost 80 orders per year during his four-year term.
Really?
Yeah.
It's pretty busy.
Yeah. He had a lot of stuff to say.
I guess so. What was the old... the old joke my mom always used to say, you got more something than Carter's got pills. Carter's got pills.
Yeah, but I don't think that's that Carter.
Yeah, well, but...
Was that old guys with the beard and the glasses that were the Carter brothers or something. Carter brothers liver pills or something.
I was going to say something about...
Carter's got peanuts. He was a peanut farmer.
Got more of those than Carter's got executive orders.
Yeah, well, it worked. He was a peanut farmer, though.
So one of the arguments has been that Congress actually has no power to define... subject to the jurisdiction and the terms of citizenship in a manner contrary to the Supreme Court's understanding of the 14th Amendment, based on those two cases that I talked about, the Wong, Kim, Ark, and Elk, since Congress does not have broad power to pass necessary and proper legislation to regulate naturalization under the Constitution. Historian Eric Foner has explored the question of birthright citizenship, and basically what he says is that birthright citizenship stands as an example of the much-abused idea of American exceptionalism. Birthright citizenship does not make the United States, along with Canada, unique in the developed world. No European nation recognizes this principle. So basically, there's some people that really feel this is kind of a bad thing.
Yes, and while we tend to think that this is just current, that it's been unchallenged since, you know, when it was put in place back in 1800s, that's not the case.
Yeah.
There have been lots of people from both sides of the aisle that have brought this up as a bad thing and needs to be fixed.
Yeah. I mean, I always think of it as kind of the American dream, that a baby born here in the U.S. has a chance to become an American citizen and live a good life and live the American dream and whatnot. But, you know, I do kind of see the whole argument in differentiating between someone who is here legally and someone is here illegally and obtaining U.S. citizenship that way. So, I mean, I think there's some problems there.
Well, and not only that, in some ways, they almost flaunt it at us. Have you heard of birthright tourism?
I have, yeah.
So, the United States is one of the few countries in the world to recognize full citizens, any child that's born in the country. Now, most of the controversy is over the children of non-citizens who have violated U.S. immigration law to illegally enter or remain in the U.S. to live and work without authorization. As full U.S. citizens, these children cannot ever be deported, are entitled to free education and social services, and when they turn 21, can sponsor their parents for legal immigration to the U.S. as immediate relatives of U.S. citizens. But with increasing frequency, the media is exposing the phenomena of birthright tourism, by which pregnant women of various foreign nationalities arrive in the U.S. on temporary tourist visas to give birth on U.S. soil. Then they return with their newborn U.S. citizen babies to their home countries. The children are raised abroad with little or no exposure to American society, culture, or values, but are entitled at any time to return to the U.S. to live and work as citizens, and when they reach the age of 21, to sponsor their parents for legal immigration.
Yeah, so see,
this is an organized business that does this and advertises it.
Yeah, I just think because you're here on vacation and have a baby here, I don't think you should be granted, your child should be granted U.S. citizenship based upon that.
Right.
And that is actually happening.
Yeah, and a lot of them, they'll get dual citizenship. They'll be U.S. citizens and go back and also have citizenship of the country where they came from. But that gives them the option later on. And of course, it's wealthier people for the most part that are participating in that, because you don't have people that are, you know, living in grass huts and riding donkeys saving up for these tourism vacations go have their babies.
That's right.
So
one of the interesting things, which is kind of unique to the U.S. and Canada, is that there's a lot of Canadians that live right along the border with the U.S. right there. And and a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times, the larger population areas in the U.S., so there's some bigger cities along the border where Canadians actually have to seek medical treatment across the border, especially if there's like high-risk pregnancies and things like that, and they need a bigger hospital. So basically, any Canadian mother that has a child in one of these kind of border towns, they actually give birth to a U.S. citizen just because the baby is born here in the United States, even though they're Canadian and they live there. And likewise, I mean, there's some places where Americans are born in Canada and they have Canadian citizenship as well.
Well, they go over there to get the free health care, huh?
That's right. These are called border babies. I just like that term.
Border babies.
Yeah.
That's not as offensive as anchor babies was a term that was thrown around before.
Yeah.
Illegal couples would try to get here to have their baby on purpose to anchor them into citizenship.
Yeah. I think I want to have a line of different dolls I'm going to put out on Christmas. They're going to be called border babies.
It's going to be like, they look half Canada and half American.
Yeah. Half Canadian, half American. I have a hockey stick in one hand and a hamburger in the other.
Do you have any ketchup, eh? But what the 14th Amendment says is all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. The 14th Amendment does not say or mean that all persons born in the U.S. are citizens. There are, in fact, many examples of persons born in the U.S. who are not citizens under the 14th Amendment. And in each case, a denial of birthright citizenship to children born in the U.S. is because of the status of the parents. For example, the children of foreign diplomats, even if born in U.S. hospitals, are not considered citizens of the U.S. because they are not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Children born on U.S. soil to alien enemies in hostile occupation are not citizens for the same reason.
So basically, if we have one of those scenarios where we have these like sleeper agents that are here trying to spy on
right.
the U.S. and they have a baby here and raise them. What was that one? It had it was an 80s movie. I can't think of the name of it.
I don't know.
It was called Little Nikita and had River Phoenix in it. Did you ever see that?
The name sounds vaguely familiar, but I don't recall.
Yeah, so basically his parents were here, and they were KGB agents, and he grew up, I think it was in California or something like that, but he came to find out that they were actually KGB sleeper agents, and it was really hard on him because he was raised as like an American kid, you know, and he loved America and stuff like that. So, but anyway, so I guess he actually would not be an American citizen under that.
Correct. Like the example they gave is they said that just because you're born on U.S. soil— and if the alien enemies in hostile occupation are not citizens for the same reason, like Japan occupied two of the Aleutian Islands during World War II. Mm-hmm. If they had, you know, a baby there, the baby wouldn't be an American citizen because they were there as hostile enemies of America. So they therefore were not under American jurisdiction.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so they were saying that wouldn't be.
The Aleutian Islands, I mean, there literally had to be like two or three of those instances. I can't imagine with that many babies born in the Aleutian Islands during World War II.
Well, they gave that as an
Japanese
example.
Occupiers.
They didn't say that they actually happened. They were saying that that was an example of how it could happen.
Let me just go ahead and throw this out there. It didn't happen.
But it's an example.
Okay.
It was possible.
It was possible.
Completely possible. Now, there was an example early in the Gulf War where they captured somebody that was a fighter for the other side. And when they brought him here and had him charged as an enemy combatant, he said, wait a minute, I'm an American citizen. And his parents had been here in America illegally when he was born.
Yeah.
So they basically didn't know what to do with him. So they ended up deporting him back to Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever it was that they brought him here from.
Revoking a citizenship?
Well, he denounced his U.S. citizenship after they let him go back over there.
And then once he denounced it, then they brought him back as an enemy combatant.
No, he slipped into the caves out there, whatever, in the desert.
So now one of the interesting things we were talking about, and you kind of brought this up, and this is an argument that, of all people, Mike Pence, our vice president, had brought up, was regarding the difference between citizenship granted to parents who are here in the country legally versus people who are here illegally and children being born here. I don't think that made much sense, but you're following me.
Yeah.
You're picking up what I'm putting down.
The question comes down to the phrase that you're under the jurisdiction thereof.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a Supreme Court case which kind of deals with this to some degree, and it's basically just a footnote from a 1982 case of Plyler v. Doe. And basically, it dealt with the issue of whether or not states have to provide education to children not legally admitted into the United States. So in that case, Justice Brennan wrote the majority opinion. It was a 5-4 decision and stated that no plausible distinction with respect to the 14th Amendment jurisdiction can be drawn between resident aliens whose entry into the U.S. was lawful and resident aliens whose entry was unlawful. So that one little kind of footnote in that one case, which was kind of not really even really talking about the same thing, has been cited before to kind of make the argument that, hey, if they're here illegally, it doesn't really matter. So that's kind of one of the arguments for that.
Well, the question is, was the child here illegally or were the parents here illegally?
Yeah. The child doesn't really have much of a choice.
No, if the child's brought in by the parents as opposed to being born here.
Yeah.
They don't have much of a choice, but you have that whole question of the education, while it's free, it's not free. We're all paying for it. So do we want people coming here for their free education when they're not paying into the tax system?
Yeah.
And then you have the health care concerns and things like that. I mean, that's what brings all this up. That's what makes this an issue that people, you know, if you lived on a border state, it would probably be more of an issue to you. As a matter of fact, Arizona at one point, even though it says that this law shall not be limited by any state, they tried at one point to legislate that they would not be able, they would not gain citizenship if they came into the country illegally in Arizona. They would not be granted citizenship. And of course it never made it through because they knew it wouldn't survive the test, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, like you've taught us before, most of these things come from English common law, as you said.
Yeah.
But it was a little bit different, the English common law. It was important. It was established that under English common law, a person's status was vested at birth and based upon his place of birth. A person born within the king's dominion owed allegiance to the sovereign and in turn was entitled to the king's protection. This same principle was adopted by the newly formed United States, as stated by Supreme Court Justice Noah Haynes Swain. All persons born in the allegiance of the king are natural-born subjects, and all persons born in the allegiance of the United States are natural-born citizens. Birth and allegiance go together. Such is the rule of common law, and it is the common law of this country as well as of England. Now, that changed, though, after the Revolution, after the American Revolution. We don't have that issue of allegiance.
Yeah.
And that came along with the Expatriate Act, where you're able to expatriate yourself from other countries as citizens. Because before, if you were a citizen of England, you had to stay one. You don't have the right, well, not before, still.
Yeah.
You don't have the right to denounce your citizenship. You have to pledge loyalty. But that goes against everything the United States is founded on.
It's true.
That you have to pledge loyalty to the United States because you were born here. And you can't ever have another thought about it. So, you know, we changed that a long time ago. Some other things that were brought up, like in the same regard that the Native Americans were separated out, as to, even though there's no question they were born here, but they did not gain citizenship by being born here.
Yeah.
You know, and then they laid out the path how they could be citizens if they wanted to. There was, back in the 1930s, U.S.-born Mexican-Americans were denied citizenship protections when authorities in California and Texas deported them to Mexico during the Great Depression. Now, they were brought over here to help out. There was a big project, and they imported these Mexicans to come in and help, and then they decided, we're done with you now, and they deported them all back. And even though that several of them had children while they were here, they said, well, that doesn't matter. You still have to go back. We brought you in here, and we can send you back.
Yeah.
So they made exclusions for that. One of the other things that's, you know, constantly argued is that you can't change this with an executive order. It has to be a constitutional amendment.
Right.
That you have to do it that way. Well, that's not always been the case, because if you look at the 14th Amendment, we have changed the requirements of citizenship, such as for Native Americans, simply by Congress changing the law.
Right.
It wasn't a constitutional thing. It didn't go back to the states for ratification or anything.
Right. But the one difference you're saying there is by Congress changing the law.
You're right. By Congress changing the law. But it didn't take a constitutional amendment.
Yeah.
It just took them saying, here's what we think is better. And here's how we're going to change this so that now Native Americans have citizenship too.
Yeah. And I think Congress probably has the power to define that without having a constitutional amendment. But I just don't think I don't think it can be done with an executive order. And the timing of this whole executive order thing that Trump's bringing up, you know, it's almost one of those things that it's right before the election. He's bringing it up, and it's going to become a talking point between the left and the right, and it's going to kind of almost rally people that support him behind him for this. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it's gonna maybe stoke the flames of them to come out and vote and try to really go to the polls.
Well, back during the original debate over the 14th Amendment, a senator named Jacob Howard of Michigan, the sponsor of the Citizenship Clause, described the clause as having the same content, despite different wording, as the earlier Civil Rights Act of 1866, namely that it excludes American Indians who maintain their tribal ties and persons born in the United States who are foreigners, aliens, who belong to the families of ambassadors or foreign ministers. Others also agreed that the children of ambassadors and foreign ministers were to be excluded. However, concerning the children born in the United States to parents who are not U.S. citizens and not foreign diplomats, three senators, including Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lyman Trumbull, the author of the Civil Rights Act, as well as President Andrew Johnson, asserted that both the Civil Rights Act and the 14th Amendment would confer citizenship to them, and no senator offered a contrary opinion. Most of the debate at this session of the amendment centered on whether the wording in the Civil Rights Act or Howard's proposal more effectively excluded Aboriginal Americans on reservations and in U.S. territories from citizenship. Senator James Doolittle of Wisconsin asserted that all Native Americans are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, so that the phrase Indians taxed would be preferable. But Trumbull and Howard disputed this, arguing that U.S. government did not have full jurisdiction over Native American tribes. Now, in the late 1990s, opposition arose over the long-standing practice of granting automatic citizenship on jus soli basis. Fears grew in some circles that the existing law encouraged parents-to-be to come to the United States to have children in order to improve the parents' chances of attaining legal residency themselves. A Pew Hispanic Center analysis of Census Bureau data determined that about 8% of children born in the United States in 2008, or about 340,000, were offspring of unauthorized immigrants. In total, about 4 million American-born children of unauthorized immigrant parents resided in the country in 2009, along with about 1.1 million foreign-born children of unauthorized immigrant parents.
I mean, it's obviously a large number.
Yeah, and
it's significant.
You know what it dates back to? What influences to the point that it's at now? Remember when we talked about the Immigration Act of 1965, and the Democrats wanted to change it to the chain, more like the chain migration type thing, and they shifted the numbers in it, and they said, you're not going to see any effect from it. It's changing the laws and allowing some other countries to have a shot to get in here, but it's not going to change anything. And remember, and we talked about how it had a major influence mm-hmm. on what happened after that, and they hadn't accounted for it right. Well, that was what has caused this to kick up to where it has. But surprisingly, both Democrats and Republicans have introduced legislation aimed at narrowing the application of the Citizenship Clause. In 1993, Senator Harry Reid, remember him, Democrat from Nevada? He introduced legislation that would limit birthright citizenship to the children of U.S. citizens and legally resident aliens. And similar bills have introduced have been introduced by other legislators in every Congress since. So, I mean, they've had Citizens Reform Act of 2005. They've had Birthright Citizenship Act of 2007 and of 2009. Some legislators are unsure whether such acts of Congress would survive court challenges. Senate Joint Resolution 6, introduced on January 16, 2009, proposes such an amendment. However, neither this nor any proposed amendment has yet been approved by Congress for ratification by the states.
Now, one of the things that the citizenship denial type body has focused on are the words subject to the jurisdiction of, and we talked about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, they're saying that basically citizens of foreign countries, even if they live in the U.S., are not subject to U.S. jurisdiction, and thus their children should not be covered by the clause. But the one way you can kind of argue against that, to test this idea, basically, if a foreign citizen rear ends you, your car, and on your drive home, will you or the police allow him to drive away on the grounds that a foreign citizen cannot be arrested, ticketed, or sued? And that's not true. They are under the jurisdiction of the U.S.
Well, they are, but first of all, they came in here illegally, so they're in violation of the law already.
I'm not talking about legal or illegal. I'm talking about to the subject to the jurisdiction argument.
Right.
There's two different arguments there.
Right. I know, and that's what I'm saying. First of all, you entered illegally. So have you just by the fact that you entered illegally, are you already saying I'm not subject to your laws? Then the other part of it is, suppose we had a drafted in place, would that person be subject to being drafted?
So you're saying that basically since they're here illegally, they're not subject to the jurisdiction, so they can't be arrested?
No, they can be arrested, but you can also be arrested even if you're not a citizen of this country.
Right.
I mean, if you came here and you're European,
so, exactly.
And you came here and you violated the laws, you would be arrested. That doesn't mean you have the right to citizenship.
By your own words, even if you're not a citizen of this country, you can still be arrested. You're
right.
Still subject to the jurisdiction of it.
Yeah, that doesn't. You're not subject to the jurisdiction. You just have to follow the laws.
No, because basically the way the clause is written and what it says is, let's go back to it. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside.
Well, by that logic, anyone could come here from any country, break a law, and now they have the right to be a citizen.
If they're here and their child is born here, because they're subject to the jurisdiction. If on a strict reading of how that reads.
But you're not subject to the jurisdiction for all things, just some things. Like, in other words, you couldn't draft an illegal alien into fight if there was a draft in place.
But that's not what the amendment says, though, is it? The amendment doesn't make a caveat for drafts.
No, but it says subject to the jurisdiction of.
Yeah.
And the jurisdiction of includes all elements of being a U.S. citizen.
Well, I just kind of disagree with you on that.
Well,
I think I'm not necessarily agreeing with the whole policy of it, but I'm just saying, based on a strict reading of it, I mean, the way it's written, you know, if you're here inside the confines of the U.S. territory or something like that, you are subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S., unless you are a foreign diplomat or something like that. And by that token, if you are subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. and you have a child born here.
Well, here's this guy that studies this thing. He's some kind of professor. His name's Eastman. We just gradually started assuming that birth was enough. Eastman attributes some of it to our nation's loss of an intrinsic understanding of the language that the framers of the 14th Amendment spoke and used in that era. Ergo, a century later, the phrase subject to the jurisdiction has been watered down in the collective American consciousness to require little more than an adherence to traffic safety laws. Thomas Jefferson talks about immigration in very favorable terms, but what the framers were trying to do then was populate a continent so it could withstand European pressures to take us back over again. The dynamic has now changed, and what we have done by having very low quotas on legal immigration and turning a blind eye to massive illegal immigration is to create this subclass and create this extraordinary drain on our social services that is bankrupting most of the state and local governments.
So the law needs to be changed.
Yes.
So, I mean,
it needs to be clarified. What they're saying is, in 18, whatever that was, that they passed this law,
mm-hmm.
The language of the day is not the same as we would speak now. And that's what they're saying, is that that meant. And depending on, you know, a lot of these things, you took notes in these committees, and the people that took notes took shorthand. Mm-hmm. So where a comma goes or something like that may make bearing on how you say it. So like when they defined it and they said foreigners, aliens, diplomats, were those separate categories, or were they saying foreigners, aliens that are ambassadors or diplomats? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's four separate categories, then you're saying that these people are excluded from it. But we're going back and trying to interpret from notes from, you know, 200 years ago.
Yeah, and that's why it needs clarification, probably by something by Congress.
Well, it's a worthwhile debate to have.
I think so. It's not as black and white as you would think it is.
No, it's not. I was surprised that there's been as much movement on it as it has. I mean, that there have been people. It's been discussed for a long time is what I mean. I mean, to me, this was a topical subject that just came up because Trump said he was going to do that. Now you go looking back, and here was Harry Reid back in the 90s ish, trying to get a act passed that essentially would do the same thing as what Trump's talking about.
Right. So, you know, maybe a worthwhile thing, but I think it's something I'd have a problem with it going through executive order. I think, you know, hey, let's do this with through Congress.
Right, but I don't think it needs a constitutional amendment. I think that it can be defined by Congress and passed as a law, just like they updated it concerning Native Americans.
Probably true.
See, one of the other things they said is, why couldn't you, if you meant everybody born here, why wouldn't the wordings just say all persons born or naturalized in the United States, period? Because if you add and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, and that means everybody that's here, that's just superfluous, that you don't need that. So that was added for a reason. And that's what their argument is that the reason is it was saying these are people that are here illegally. They're not subject to the jurisdiction. They're still following their own country. They didn't expatriate and come here.
Well, I mean, jurisdiction, I mean, in my mind, and this is maybe just because I'm a lawyer, but jurisdiction to me means the ability to be subject to a certain court.
Right. But that's your definition now in 2018.
Well, I think that's
what was there.
That's probably legal definition of anyone dating back to common law.
Well, but language changes.
But jurisdiction doesn't.
Well, that may not have been the way they may not have strictly defined it that way as far as what court you're subject to.
I don't know. I mean, when I say subject to the jurisdiction of, I mean, that basically means something maybe different to me because, you know, hey, that's I'm a lawyer, you know.
Well, I know. And you would think in law terms. And that's what I mean. Who's to say for sure? But that's why there's this open interpretation and this ambiguity. And when you look back at the laws that are cited, when they say, well, when has this been decided? Well, you go back to that case that you talked about with the Chinese couple that was here.
Wong Kim Ark.
Right. You go back to that. That's the case that's mostly cited. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about people that were here legally.
Right. And you can definitely make that differentiation. And I think, I mean, I know where you're coming from. You're basically saying people that avail themselves to the jurisdiction of the U.S. by legal manner, as opposed to ones that are here illegal.
Right.
And I see where that's definitely a bright line. But just for purposes of this argument, I don't think it's enough based on the language. That's just my opinion. I think it needs to be something changed.
Well, they've made the comment that the reason that it's been debated but never been acted on, as they say, the Republicans, in one vein, don't mind the illegal aliens coming in because it's cheaper labor for them to use to run, you know, work their farms and run their factories and things like that. And the Democrats don't mind because that's people that are going to vote for them and keep them in office.
Yeah.
So they have, you know, political or financial motivations into not doing anything when it comes right down to it, but they both have recognized, hey, maybe this isn't so good for the good of our country give this away. And not only that, what about all these other countries out there that don't do that? You know, are we the only ones that are right? We're that much smarter than everybody else that we're doing it right and everybody else is doing it wrong? Because you can't do that, you know, like I say, Canada and then some small countries after that. But you know, Europe doesn't do that.
No, nobody does.
Go drop a baby in London and see if that baby can subscribe to the king, to the crown.
Maybe we're having tea and crumpets before noon.
Might be, but can't officially have them. You're going to have a foreign slice of it.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we go over different legal terms and different phrases that we talked about. And this one's going to be Latin heavy.
Oh, no.
Jus soli. What does that mean?
Of the soil.
Right, of the soil. And that's the basically the one derived from English common law.
It means if you're born there, then you're in there.
Yep, that's pretty much what we have here in the U.S. Almost right. a straight right of the soil, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Jus sanguinis.
That's the right of the blood. Is that means that like your one or both of your parents were of a citizenship, so you get that citizenship.
Right. Gallia est in Europa.
That means France is in Europe.
It does.
And Germania est provincia.
Provincia?
Mm-hmm.
Germany is a province?
Correct.
Oh, okay. I do remember that V was pronounced as a W.
Femini et pueli est pulcri.
Ah, the woman is very pretty?
Women and girls are pretty.
Oh. It's close.
Close.
This is going to be, it's not legal briefs, it's Latin briefs.
Well,
I remember Charles had a phrase that he always thought was funny that Father Meehan had taught him.
Mm-hmm.
It was ete stericus et immorere.
I don't have any idea.
It's basically eat poop and die.
What? That's not a good one.
Well, when you're in eighth grade in Latin, you think it's really funny.
Yeah, I know. Charles used to lay there and listen to my Jimmy Buffett live album just so he could hear Jimmy Buffett say some bitch, and then he'd just giggle. He thought that was so funny hearing somebody say a bad word on a song.
What is a border baby?
A border baby is between America and Canada. When cities that are right on the border between them, you may go to a Canadian hospital to have your baby if you're American, or if you're Canadian, you might go to an American hospital to have your baby.
And the last one, what does jurisdiction mean?
That is up for interpretation. What it meant in 1866 or 68 or whatever, what it meant then and what it means now is open for interpretation. But that's something that they're going to have to determine is the jurisdiction and how does that apply and where do the commas fall in the exceptions of who was supposed to be included in that. But the thing is, you know, it may not ever make it that far. Because, like I say, it's been brought up a lot of times, and nothing's ever been done about it.
It's a very verbose way to define jurisdiction. I would have also agreed the official power to make legal decisions and judgments over.
Or which court you're going to.
Pretty much. So
we're going to court that we're appointed to.
That's right. I think. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf, and I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.